start the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee on this day, the 24th. And the first bill up is Senate Bill 508A. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 508A. I have another bill that's happening over in Ag and Natural Resources, and the other down is B, so I'm going to come in and go. I have to go testify in a little while. So my able vice chair will take over at that time. And we got two of them. I got a choice now. But we'll do the one that was on time. We'll do the one that was on time.
Unable.
You and I are in the same doghouse.
We can divide it up.
And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 508A would allow freestanding hospice facilities and existing dwellings and one accessory building to locate on land zoned for exclusive farm use, provided they don't exceed 10,000 square feet of total floor area, and 12 patient beds of the existing dwelling qualifies for alteration, restoration, or replacement. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, no statement was issued, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. So, with that, we'll call up Margie Brooks and Cheryl Boren. Is that correct? Boren, thanks.
No.
That's what you need to call us.
Oh.
Because we had another bill that someone was going to testify.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Margie Brooks, Vice President of McKenzie Willamette Community Health Foundation, which is under the umbrella of Cascade Health Solutions, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm really just reading a letter from our land use attorney because he's in the hospital as of last night, and he had written this letter to you, of which you're getting copies of right now. And it reads, The Honorable Arnie Roblin Chair, Dear Honorable Roblin, this letter is submitted on behalf of our clients, Cascade Health Solutions, the primary advocate for SB 508. This bill recognizes the growing importance of end-of-life care issues for all Oregonians and ensures that our land use system will accommodate freestanding hospice facilities in serene environments throughout the state. Cascade Health Solution urges the committee to move this legislation to the floor with a due pass recommendation. SB 508 strikes a balance between public health policy and land use policy. While it permits freestanding hospice facilities, the current bill allows counties to condition approvals to ensure the hospices do not force a significant change in surrounding farm or forest practices or significantly increase the cost of those operations. The bill also requires that freestanding hospice facilities be located in existing dwellings, which is required, imposed on other non-farm uses on farmland, and imposes limits to the total structure size and number of patient beds to minimize the hospice footprint. Last, the proposed amendment ensures that freestanding hospice facilities will not contribute further to the parcelization of farmland. SB 508 represents a measured and narrow exception to the fundamental principle of protecting resource land for resource use. This bill is grounded in the understanding that Oregonians are seeking alternatives to their end-of-life care choices, and it appropriately balances the competing public policy arenas of health care and land use. We encourage each of the committee members to vote in favor of SB 508.
Thank you. We'll let both of you talk, and then we'll have some questions.
All right. Okay. And I am Cheryl Boyam. I'm CEO of Cascade Health Solutions. And Cascade Health Solutions is a nonprofit community health organization in Lane County. And we're dedicated to meeting the unmet health needs in our community. And I also thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I'd like to just briefly define hospice, explain a little bit more about a hospice house, and then talk to you about the need for this bill. Hospice delivers compassionate care to individuals at the end of their life, and usually this care is delivered in their place of residence. This valuable service focuses on quality of life through pain management and symptom management, as well as helping individuals find meaning in the final phase of their life. Hospice involves a dedicated team of professionals who offer both physical, emotional, and spiritual comfort and support to both the patient and the patient's family. Currently, hospice cares for over half of all Americans who die of cancer and a growing number of other life-threatening diseases such as end-stage lung and heart disease. In 2000, of all Americans who died, approximately 25% died at home. That means close to 75% died in hospitals or medical facilities, which are often unable to provide an environment conducive to the special needs of the dying patient. In a recent Time CNN poll, it was stated that 7 out of 10 Americans prefer to die in their home with surrounded by family and loved ones. However, there are times where that is very difficult. Either the patient has a crisis with their physical health or the family members are unable to provide for the care. A hospice house provides an option for these scenarios in which a patient who wants to be in their home, unable to, can go to a house that resembles a home, has the same environment, but is able to provide the type of nursing and medical care that's needed. A patient's stay in a hospice house usually is an average of 4 to 5 days, so it's a very short stay, at which time their focus is really to get their symptoms under control, to provide respite for the family so that they can then return to their home. Professional nursing staff, which is really experienced in hospice care and dedicated to truly improving the quality of life of these patients, is there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to provide the care. Additional social workers, complementary therapists, and chaplains are available as needed. The patient's primary care physician or the hospice medical director is there to supervise care. The architecture of a hospice home really resembles a regular home and really strives to fit in with the neighborhood, the other homes that are close to it. A very important part of a hospice house is the landscaping, because we really are trying to create serenity, peace, and beauty for the patients that's dying. And so you will find in most hospice houses, both people who look at it from the outside and the patients who are able to look out of their windows are surrounded by a really beautiful, serene landscape. The interior of the house looks and feels like a home. It has a living room, a kitchen, a dining room. Bedrooms are really decorated in a very positive and uplifting, very comfortable environment that resembles a home. In Oregon, there are currently only 2 hospice houses. One is in Portland, one is in Bend. There's currently been a certificate of need approved for another one that will be going in Beaverton. Cascade Health Solutions actually provides one of 2 hospice programs in Lane County. Between us, our 2 programs serve around 1,000 patients each year who are dying. Early last year, the medical community actually identified a real need in our community for a hospice house, and they approached Cascade Health Solutions and asked if we would help them in actually building and running a hospice house for the patients in Lane County. We then turned to the community and asked them for their support, and we were just overwhelmingly surprised by the amount of community support and the pledges of substantial financial support that the community is willing to give to actually make this a reality. The challenge that we are facing that is in Lane County, there is truly a scarcity of land. After a very intensive search for land that would meet the criteria for a hospice house, that was both affordable, that was close to physicians, close to family members, but also had the environment that was conducive to what we're trying to achieve, we came up with no available options within the city limits. Cascade Health Solution does own a piece of property, 3/4 of an acre, right outside the urban growth boundary. And so we started a search to see, is there a way we could build on this? This property is zoned as exclusive farm use. It currently has a duplex on it. The current EFU zoning allows special use permits, and one of them is for a residential care facility. So we really pursued that option, thinking maybe we could do it and license it under that licensure. After an evaluation of whether it would qualify as a residential care facility and multiple discussions with the Department of Human Services, we finally, and they actually are the ones that license both hospice facilities and residential care, it was determined that this was not the best option. Really, residential care facilities have rules that are not well suited for the short-term end-of-life needs of a hospice house. And a residential care facility license wouldn't allow a hospice house to get some of the reimbursement from Medicare that some of the patients need. So given the growing need for hospice houses in Oregon and the lack of available land, I guess we would like to respectfully ask that you would approve the proposed amendments to the land use statute so we'll permit the location of a freestanding hospice on EFU lands. We have heard concerns from the opposition, and we have really taken a lot of seriousness to their concerns and have actually modified the bill multiple times, putting into it the things that they have actually recommended. So in summary, I would just like to say the underlying philosophy of a hospice house is to provide compassionate care and support for a dying patient in a quiet, respectful, and beautiful environment. As a result, we believe that a hospice house would blend nicely with the state's farmlands. The presence of this home would have minimal impact on neighbors, on farming, and on the overall environment. And it would provide a wonderful option to the dying patient, one that any of us would hope we would be able to offer someone that we love. So I just want to thank you very much ahead of time for your serious consideration of this, and we, again, would just respectfully urge that you would send this to your floor with a due pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Klein.
You had mentioned that the property that you purchased is just outside the urban growth boundary, and I'm wondering, to the east, west, are we Springfield, are we Eugene?
It is Eugene. It's right, I don't know if you're familiar, it's about 100 feet from the freeway, mm-hmm. And it's very, just right outside the urban growth. There is a produce stand right next to the land, and there is, like I said, currently a duplex on it, but it's just right outside of it. In fact, our offices are probably 2 minutes away from it.
Following. Do you think it's pretty mm-hmm. likely that when Eugene expands urban growth boundary, it'll be coming into within a buildable area anyway?
I think our concern with, I don't know if you've been following, I think even that, Eugene, if it was in Springfield, yes, I believe so. Unfortunately, Eugene, I think, is very resistant to expanding any of their urban growth boundaries, and I think that's why Springfield has really tried to separate from them, because there really, truly is not land available in Eugene.
I did follow up. I mean, was there an effort to look into when the next UGB expansion might be that might cover it versus coming to the state directly?
We actually met with the land use through county mm-hmm. and spent a lot of time with them. They were very supportive of what we were trying to do. They told us probably the only way that you can get this is to go through the legislature. That's why we turned this direction. They said trying to go through the county, through the city, you're probably going to just get a dead end.
And I could just follow up to that, too, by saying if we wanted to build a residential care facility on this piece of property in the current standing, we'd be able to do it tomorrow. Okay. All we're asking to do is classify it as a home care or a hospice house.
May I follow up on that?
Mm-hmm.
So you're fairly certain. I think one of you described it as it is an allowable, permitted mm-hmm. exception. You're pretty certain you could get the exception?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the county basically said they would approve that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know, because we do have residential care facilities, mm-hmm. What the difference might be. Just
a residential care facility, usually somebody's actually moving into that is their residence. And so there are restrictions as far as what you have to put into the facility. There's also a lot of restrictions as to what, for example, if you're once you're in there, you can't discharge someone without giving them, I think it's like 30 days notice. Mm-hmm. There's restrictions on Medicare reimbursement. And so what a hospice is by nature of a hospice house, is usually for very short term, 4 or 5 days, respite care, or really helping somebody get their symptoms managed. If you look at residential care facilities, most of them are more institutionalized. You know, a hospice home is truly like an old home, you know, that resembles that. So that's the main differences.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm confused. Everything else made sense until you said that residential care facilities are allowed on lands that are zoned for exclusive farm use.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I don't. It's hard to see the connection to agriculture. So on what basis is?
I think it's this particular property might have already been zoned.
No, it's an exception.
It's
an exception.
It's an exception.
Yeah.
Which
it's covered by ORS 443.400 through 443.825.
It wasn't an exception at the beginning. They keep asking for exceptions like schools and other kinds of things. One exceptions, and this would be a different list. I guess my question is, this one doesn't just take care of Eugene. It makes it another use anywhere in the state. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. It is.
And so my concern in your description of a house, and I appreciate that because I have a lot of friends that work in hospice in my hometown, and I know, and I appreciate the organization. But my concern is we have a section of laws also in the statutes that describe what right to farm is.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's not necessarily a place where it's quiet and calm and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Farming mm-hmm. involves things like tractors at 4 o'clock in the morning and animals coming and going and smells that some people don't particularly like and spraying and all sorts of other kinds of activities that don't seem that they would necessarily be compatible with this kind of a house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worry that when they get placed in different places, all of a sudden the people who are there and the others start saying, we don't want these other activities to happen around us, even though they should have understood that when they got there. So any answer to that?
I think, I guess, from a provider who would be looking at locating a home, I would consider those things before you even, you know, made a decision that this might be an appropriate place. The other thing that we did write into this statute was that the county would be able to also evaluate whether it is a good blend with the piece of property that they're looking at and could put restrictions or could even deny the application. So I think there's the two things. There's one, the provider would look at it, but also the county has the ability to evaluate that. I know in the testimony at the Senate, there was a physician that one of the senators was basically saying he was a physician in farm country, and he personally believed that many of his patients were farmers, that they would like to be in a hospice house that was next to a farm with all the things that you mentioned, because that is what their home is. So it probably just depends on which eyes you look for through it.
Representative Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, ladies. I'm looking at the actual bill, and I want to make sure the intent's in the record here, because you made mention of several things, and interestingly enough, I see a dash 5 and a dash 6 amendment, which means it's not as bad as island annexation. I think we were over 20, Mr. Chair.
That's true.
But it's an issue related here. In the bill itself, ladies, I mean, it talks about it must be an existing dwelling,
right.
Which means it previously had to have been an existing approved farm property.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, obviously they're not farming it anymore in this individual case you're talking about.
Right.
But as I read the bill and as your intent is here, it looks to me is that this could only be done in an existing previously approved farm dwelling that had been abandoned or was no longer under farm practices. Does that sound logical?
Yeah,
correct.
Because what we found, there are homes on farmland you know, and so the intent was not to go out into open space and build something brand new, but to take where there already is an existing dwelling.
Follow them, sure. Mm-hmm. In fact, it wouldn't matter what your tenant is. The way this law would be written is it had to be an existing dwelling. You could remodel it, but it was an existing dwelling on a farm parcel under EFU that was no longer being used as farm.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Klein.
Just clarifying that point, it doesn't necessarily mean it's no longer being used as farm. The farmer could be the one to sell it with the existing dwelling on it to a person.
Yes.
At that moment, it would leave farm use and go to hospice use. A different question. The comment you made about, I think it was the doctor who kind of practiced out in farmland and said, I just need to know a little bit more about hospice houses versus sort of the hospice program generally. I'm shaping this from experience. My father-in-law died 3 or 4 years ago. He was a farmer his whole life, died in the farmhouse with his family around him. But he was, quote, in hospice, but he was in his own home. So what is hospice? Who uses hospice houses versus who has, like, a hospice nurse come and visit sometimes, which I think is what his situation was.
And that's what the ideal is, and that's what our hospice program does. We serve people wherever their residence is, you know, so in their home. But there are times that as somebody nears the end of life, that they can go through extreme agitation where families are unable to deal with it. They can also go through extreme pain. They can, you know, become very disoriented. So they can be dealing with very, very severe physical crisis. And unless the family members are truly trained, it's very, very difficult for those people to continue to get that care in their home. And so generally what happens now with those people, they will usually go into a hospital to have their symptoms managed. And what we've found with hospice houses that it is a 24-hour inpatient stay, that these people can go into a home that's truly a home where they get the support, the medical support they need, but it's more in an environment similar to their own home. The other thing that they are used for is respite care, because some families just really get to the point where it is very difficult for them to continue to give 24-hour care 7 days a week, and they need a break. And so what happens oftentimes now is that these people, they will put their loved one into a nursing home, for example, so that they can have some time just to restore themselves so they can return to the caregiver role. And so this is also another reason that people would use a hospice house, to give that caregiver some time. And then the patient returns home and they assume their responsibilities again.
Just one little follow-up.
Okay, one last.
I know there are other ways of doing hospice where people will come and stay 24 hours and didn't get relief. But I just wondered how many are currently in Oregon now. I just don't know how this is an evolution probably of how to do this. How many do we have now?
Hospice houses?
Uh-huh.
We have two. We have one in Portland and one in Bend. And there is a new one being built in Beaverton.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next we'll have Kendall Bergstrom, Jim Marr, and Dustin Wyant.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Jim Marr, for the record. I'm here representing Kendall Bergstrom and Dustin Wyant, who in just a moment will share with you a concept that is coined agritourism. It's a new idea, but not a new idea in other states, and certainly not a new idea in Europe. And in brief, the concept is a chance to combine, obviously, agriculture and, where possible, tourism in an experiential mode. Kendall and Dustin have extensive experience as winemakers and in the hospitality and tourism industries. And the Dash 6 amendments propose a, we think, very exciting and new idea that would allow folks under very strict, limited conditions to allow folks to visit Oregon and experience the bounty of our crops and Kendall and Dustin's case, the wine industry. I grew up in McMinnville in the heart of Yamhill County's wine country and have watched the small towns around McMinnville and Newburgh, specifically Carlton, Yamhill, wither and die on the vine. As you all know, the timber recession hit little towns all over Oregon tough. Tourism via the wine industry, which has, as you well know, become a world-class industry, and we're fortunate to have such an opportunity in the state. It has created in all of your districts an amazing array of individuals who come here to do this combination of art and farming called winemaking. And the people that gather to do this work are some of the most amazing Oregonians that I've ever met. And they have created a product in our communities across the state that has international and national interest. In Yamhill County alone, state statistics tell us that 1.5 million people come to Yamhill County to most likely visit the wine industry, to experience it, to taste wine. In Yamhill County, if you add up all of the B&Bs, there's 100 rooms. Now, there's a Shiloh in Newburgh. But folks who pay $40 and $50 a bottle for wine come here to purchase our products, experience Oregon and all that it has to offer. A lot of those folks aren't interested in the B&B class as far as lodging goes. In Oregon, we find ourselves lacking a high-end way to house the folks who want to come here and spend their money and experience all the great things Oregon has to offer. So the agritourism concept has grown out of that need, and I want to allow Kendall and Dustin to share with you more about their vision and what they've discovered about where we think we need to go in the way of land use. This is a modest proposal. It's a demonstration project. And we think it's also an opportunity for Oregonians to experience what is our best hope in these small communities where I grew up and where Dustin and Kendall live and raise their families. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Dash 6 amendments today, and I'll turn it over to Kendall Bergstrom.
Good afternoon. My name is Kendall Bergstrom, for the record. I am here in support of Senate Bill 508-6 amendments. And I appreciate you taking the time to listen to our concept, which is very exciting. And on an aside, I have to tell you, as just a resident of Oregon, going through this process, I know you've been heavily involved in the last 6 weeks here, and you're probably exhausted. But as a resident and just a citizen, it's very exciting to go through this process. It's stressful. It's exciting. It's happy. It's down. It's up. And we've run the gamut of emotions and taken some arrows. But I've got to tell you, for the whole big picture, it's very exciting to finally be here today. So thanks. My background is I'm an owner in Bergstrom Winery. I also own with my husband the Lancelotti Family Vineyards. My father's vineyard and our vineyard are the first of several biodynamic certified vineyards in Oregon, and we're very proud of that because biodynamics, Demeter certified biodynamics, is the most strict farming practices that you can adhere to. They're very expensive, but it's the right thing to do. We see in our culture today a paradigm shift in the values, global warming. It's very serious that our earth is dying, and we've done a lot to lead to that in the last 50 years. And we feel that this shift in our children's awareness of where food comes from, especially living on our vineyard and having our children understand that we do not use chemicals, because the chemicals here would go down to the Lakini family below, and the water system may be compromised, and they may be drinking chemicals. And it's a phenomenal opportunity to be that connected. Growing up in Beaverton with my mom and living on the weekends with my dad in Portland, we never got that concept. And I feel like our, the urbanization, we're kind of becoming hemmed in, and we don't experience nature nature were not as connected, so I feel extremely lucky to be living on a biodynamic vineyard right now and raising my children that way. So when Dustin and I became connected in terms of mutual friends and saying, how do we have 1.5 million people coming out here every year. 750,000 are from Portland, and 750 are from around the world. And they come out, our tasting rooms are open from 11 to 4. They drink. We see them in our tasting rooms. We give them water, tons of water if they're drunk. But very few have designated drivers, and they go back to Portland because there's nowhere to stay. And so we also have this other concept that our little towns are dying. If you drive through these little towns, no one's investing in them. The Starwood Hotels groups, the W groups, they're looking by and saying none of these businesses are thriving. It's too seasonal. It's too 11 to 4. It's too Memorial Day to Labor Day. And so we really, over the past year and a half, have said, how do we create a win-win? We have land use laws that say that you can only do B&Bs. Or if you're outside of an urban growth boundary, out 30 miles outside, you can do a destination resort. That precludes the entire Willamette Valley. So we don't have a vehicle. And so we really sat down with the people who we thought would oppose it and really tried to create a collaborative effort to say, let's create a win-win here. We're biodynamic farmers. Our kids go to the same parties together. Let's figure out a way to revitalize our towns while allowing people to come out to the country and have a beautiful experiential stay and teach them about farming. And then we looked at how do you get the seasonality aspect. You know, this is really tough for any normal traditional group to come in and invest in our areas with the seasonality picture, whereas in other climates you'll have sunny January and a beautiful place that you can go and lay out in the sun while looking at the vineyards that are dormant. We don't have that luxury in Oregon. And so what we arrived at was we looked at what do they do in France and Italy and New Zealand, and we looked at agritourism there. And while their land use models are very different than they are here in the United States, let alone Oregon, which our petri dish of land use is, as we know, is much different. How do we create a win-win? So we thought, well, number one, it has to have a very heavy agricultural overlay. If we attempt to go into our farmlands and have an experiential stay and teach people about gardening and farming and vineyards. So on EFU lands, this would create an exception. And what it would allow us to do is to have acreage between 80 and 400 acres be developed for an agritourism facility with an overwhelming agricultural overlay. So 85% of the total site, of any of these total sites, remains in a conservation agreement with permanent agriculture. It has to be an active working farm. And that sets the stage for this, what do you do with this little 15% left over? Let's see what we can create so that we have year-round sustainability, so these really are successful out of the gate. The components then become a boutique inn, so 25 to 75 room inns, a culinary kitchen so that people can come and take the food from the sustainable farm and the vineyard operation and the winery operation. They can come and have a stay with a guest chef, with a guest winemaker. And then the year-round portion, having a half of a home site per each lodging unit. So if you were going to do 25 rooms, it would be 12 home sites. And if it was going to be 75 rooms, it would be 38. The home owners, we envision being farmers. We envision people who are super passionate about agriculture and wanting to be involved. So there would be a CCNR restriction that is heavily weighted, but these people are involved and integrated into the sustainable farm and integrated into the vineyard. So they are working the farm. It becomes like a live-work collective, if you will. And we believe that the people who actually invest in these properties are going to be integral. Those are the people who in October, November, December, January are going to be saying to their friends around the country and around the world, in France and in New Zealand and Chile, come see Oregon. Come see Oregon. Come over here. Spend the holidays. And come see our town. See what we're doing here. It's not the busy tourist time. It's when people are kind of traveling and in the off-season. And we really believe these are the kinds of people who are going to say to their children, there's some neat things going on here. Come and open up your floral shop in Carlton. You know what? You should do that goat and cheese or charcuterie in Dundee. And we feel that this is the revitalization piece that is going to bring the new businesses to our small rural town. Because right now as you drive by, no one's investing. People are passing saying it's seasonal, it's depressed. There are several wine country cities that are truly on the distressed community list in Oregon. So we feel that this is a beautiful win-win situation that has been very well thought through. We hope that you look at the whole projects, the kind of concept in the projects very seriously. We put a lot of time into it, and mostly because we are farmers who really want to teach our kids about the future of our farms, our fruit, our orchards, our vineyards, our berries and things. We think this educational piece will be huge also. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk. Kendall and I have had a passionate view on this issue since we've met. I most recently have moved back from Montana. I grew up in Central Oregon. And I've spent the last 11 years running hospitality facilities in Montana, most recently just outside of Glacier National Park. And we dealt with a lot of similar issues and how do we balance our lands and the fact that what we're really promoting is the beauty of our natural resource. And one of the things that we experienced in Montana was the fact that tourism is really based on experience. It's based on touching and feeling and smelling and understanding the root of what you're seeing. It's not just go and buy a t-shirt and bring it back and give it to a family member and that was your vacation. And we see this trend in our lifestyle, what people think about their food supply, and what people think about what they're eating and drinking on a daily basis. And so this concept is truly rooted in green practices. As you read through the legislation, we talk about a lot of the guidelines in terms of construction, the LEED process of green architecture, and of operational in terms of energy efficiency. So what we want to do is create a place that's world-class that people can actually come and see why Oregon agricultural products are so renowned, why our wines are so good. And the difference is that we take care of our environment. And that was the basis for the agritourism concept. It's a European concept in its origination, but it's all over the world. In New Zealand, I've stayed on agritourism farms, and some of these farms are really small. They're 5 rooms. Some of them are large. They're 50 rooms, and they have their own winery, and they have all of these other facilities for spas and different things that operate within the farm. But the overwhelming emphasis at these facilities is the fact that you're in a working environment. You're surrounded by agriculture. If you want to take the opportunity to come and see how it grows or to see how we harvest it or to see how we take that raw product and turn it into something exceptional, come and do that. And we will be there to educate you. And so the genesis of this is in that philosophy of we need to look beyond what is on the surface. And we've really done that in involving a lot of the people around the state who are familiar with it on both sides of the issue of land use and saying, what is it going to take? What is it going to take to be able to sustain these small communities that Kendall spoke about? Right now, there's lots of for-rent signs if you drive through rural Oregon. Whether it's southern Oregon or it's eastern Oregon or it's in Hood River, there's a lot going on, but there's a lot not going on. And it's really unfortunate. These places are beautiful. They have great products to sell. And they have wonderful people who are now driving in their cars to a metro area every morning to go to work and then driving in their cars from a metro area every evening to come home and not spending time and money in their communities and with their families. And we think this really provides a base for economic revitalization of these communities and an opportunity for Oregon to finally compete on a global scale. Right now, we're losing tourists because they don't see the facilities or the infrastructure that they want, particularly wine customers, people who are looking for a wine country experience. the demographic of that person is someone who wants certain services and facilities. And honestly, we don't have them to offer right now in our wine countries. And these people are choosing to vote with their tourist dollars to go to France or to go to Walla Walla or to go to California or New Zealand or to go to Italy and all these other places that have similar concepts. They have wonderful agriculture and they have a wonderful tourist destination draw. And they're taking advantage of it right now. And I think this is a real proactive step for the state of Oregon to protect agricultural lands by taking 85%, as we've said, and saying it has to be farm use. And to set the standard for the state so that we don't wake up tomorrow and end up with something that we don't want in our agricultural lands. We all know the mess of land use and what's happening. Whatever side you're on, we're dealing with it. And it's really important, we feel, that we're able to go out and be proud of what we can create 20 years from now and say, I'm really glad we did that because it fits. It's right for this area. It's right for the state. And look what we did for these little towns. They can now survive on their own. So I really appreciate your consideration of this amendment and appreciate the time today to speak to you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand the opportunity that's created by the combination of agriculture and tourism, because there are a lot of people who are quite removed from the agricultural experience, and they get a taste of it when they come out for the day, and having overnight lodging, I think I understand the value of that. The piece in this proposal that I'm a little confused by is the provision that is on page 3 of the amendments, lines 12 to 14, mm-hmm. which says an agritourism facility may not provide more than one residential unit approved for sale for every two units of permanent overnight lodging provided under paragraph C of the subsection.
Mm-hmm.
Help me understand how the sale of a residential unit fits in with that model of the agricultural experience for somebody coming out to want to have an overnight stay in the wine country.
Yeah. It is it's a huge sustainability piece to this whole concept. So the reason that people are not the reason that people are not doing these kinds of overnight lodging is that there's no viable piece that they can sink their teeth into to say, we want to invest here. We want to invest in Oregon wine country. No one's doing it. No one's done it in 5 years. There's no hotels. There's no lodging. There's nothing. And so what we feel like, to take the seasonality out of Memorial Day to Labor Day weekend, is that you're allowing kind of more of a collective community to take place, like a little hamlet that you see in Italy or in Burgundy outside of Beaune. These little hamlets, they're much more of a European model, but are very non-invasive. We're talking a tiny number of homeowners there, that they would be able to participate in the land. So it is a live-work, and it is a tourism and agricultural piece altogether.
And it's meant to be very interactive. What we found in Montana, all of our staff lived on property. We all lived on property. And the interaction that happens that's natural as part of that process is really true to what the original community farm concept was. People come and visit. They interact with the owners. The owners are there actually working the vineyard and the land. And that's part of the learning process. Without that part of the process, the farm gets bustling when the workers are there, and then the workers leave and you have just a hotel surrounded by a farm. But if you have that live and work concept involved in the overall, you have people who are actually there and impassioned by the farm to interact with these people. They may be visiting from Portland, or they may be visiting from New York, or wherever they're coming from. They're there to share the experience. And I've found in our little microcosm of the world in Montana that those interactions with the people who were there on a daily basis were the most positive. And that's what people took away from Montana and said, this state was great and it was beautiful. And we learned about all these places we wouldn't have ever gone because we talked with this employee at this resort who lived there every day. And they experienced this. And they could tell us what they did and how they did it and why. And on a farm, it's even more important, because just to go one day and touch it and see it in an herb garden, or to go see the vines, you can get your teeth into a little bit of it. But we're talking about truly an immersion type of experience with agritourism facilities.
Follow up if I could, yes. Here. On the scale that's described here, be up to 75 units of overnight lodging, and at a 2-to-1 ratio, that would be 37.5 home sites that would be created. Would there be any obligation or anything that would assure that the people who are purchasing those home sites would be somehow engaged in the agricultural production that's going on in the rest of the property?
It's a requirement, Mr. McPherson. It is. It is through the private CC&Rs that will be on any given development, if you will. It will be required that they partake in either the vineyard aspect or the farming aspect. So they're either going to be a participant directly in the sustainable farm or a participant in the vineyard. So, for example, when we've gone out and spoke with chefs and vintners who are kind of what is known as virtual winemakers, so they do not have their own, they're either using a custom crush facility or they do not have their own winery because they don't have 15 acres of their own and they haven't been able to afford all the capital infrastructure needed to create a winery. Those are the people who are saying, I want to live there. I want to be able to make fruit from the vineyard that I live on, and or I want to be able to take the fruit from the and the produce and the meat and the cheese from the actual farm, the sustainable farm that's on the property where I live, and take it into the restaurant that I'm working in or the new restaurant that I'm going to start in the nearby city. So it's really this hamlet kind of a concept where the people we've talked to are going to be who are most likely going to be excited about coming into this kind of a community are people who are vineyard owners or vintners or chefs or people who are already involved in the agriculture business themselves. Does that seem real foreign? I mean, it's a very different concept.
I'm going to take the liberty of asking a follow-up question.
Okay.
Is there any way to, I mean, I realize the aspiration, the goal,
mm-hmm.
but what prevents it from becoming just a 37-home subdivision outside of the urban growth boundary where somebody decides I'd like to live out among the vines and commute to my job in town because I think that's a nice setting to live in?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, it is, that's a great question. This is not a model that any traditional developer of a residential neighborhood would ever want to be involved in. This is not an example of something that a traditional hotelier would ever want to do. It's a brand new concept that is a European concept that says that this can't, there's an 85% conservation overlay that has to remain in active farming. And the people who buy into the home ownership are people who are integrated every day, whether it's October after the harvest or getting the vines ready and prepping the soil in February. These are people who are going to be walking the vineyard in December or milking the goats in January. These are year-round integrated homeowners who are not ever going to follow any kind of traditional subdivision kind of a model. So in no way is this a subdivision. It's an agricultural experience that is surrounded by a hotel and a culinary kitchen, and it offers something much more exciting than just a tasting room at another winery. It is a full immersion agricultural experience where people can stay and talk to the people who live there and say, oh man, what an amazing community. And that person can say, did you know about the new restaurant that just opened down the street? You guys have got to try that. Because our experience in traveling is that the hotel restaurant becomes kind of the default restaurant, and you always want to go out into the nearby city or town, especially when you're in Europe, to say what are the great new restaurants that are opening up. And it just creates this beautiful community spirit atmosphere that we really believe will revitalize our towns.
We've also tried to write in the clauses this 85% use in active farming and all of the criteria. You basically follow the same process that a winery would follow in order to get their ability to operate a winery and a tasting room on EFU land. And so you would go through that same process. And so it's pretty restrictive. At least we tried to incorporate things that would prevent this type of thing from happening. Because the last thing we would want personally as operators is for a development to go in right next door to something we're trying to create an idyllic farm country feel about. And so if you read through the language, there's a lot of checkoffs that the county, through their processes, would have to go through and say, do you meet these criteria? And there's also a revocation ability that someone could go through and say, you've bought this land, you've done these things, and now it's not being farmed. It's not in production for farm use. And so you could lose the license to operate a facility like this. Mm-hmm. And all of these came through our kind of collaborative efforts as we've gone around the state to talk to people. And we think they're really restrictive and will prevent something like this from happening. And that's why we've written them into the language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We now have some more questions. We have about 7 more minutes for this bill before we go to the next bill, and we have 3 more people that need to talk. So with that, I will let Representative Klum ask his question and Representative Boquist, if they can keep it, and hopefully the answer will be short as well.
Yeah. So Representative McPherson got to some of my questions about residential units. I actually think that the way it's written is not drafted in the way you would want it. There's words like enable and it should be mandate. So you'd probably have to work on that if you're really intending. This is too flexible. But I guess my larger question is the intention that the farmer own the at least the hotel part, because when I'm looking at some of these things, there's concepts like the developer must spend at least $2 million on improvements, and you know there's another area about LEED standards, and I just wonder if this is going to be farmer owned, basically how many out there got $2 million that's now mandated in here would have to be spent, and is that what farmers really wanted? They want to do it to LEED standards, or how did we come up with some of these figures?
Thank you. The intention is for the developer to maintain and hold the vast majority of the entire project. As a winery and vineyard owner, it takes 10 or 11 years to make these things really viable. And so our intention is to make sure that we stay on for 15 or 18 years to make sure that these are viable. We live here. We're not going anywhere. And so our vision is that we would obviously do things LEED standard, LEED gold, renewable. We'd want all of the homes to be clustered, and so we can do sustainable water resources and uncommon wells, shared wells.
So just to clarify that there could be a developer who owns it separately from the farmer, and so they own the hotel. Someone else other than the farmer owns the hotel, and then a third party from that, those two might own the residential units as well?
That's not our intention. Our intention is to own the piece for the next 15, 16 years.
I know years, but the law's intention is also to have it be that it's the farmer themselves, the property owner who owns the hotel, not a private developer who maybe shares some of the profits with them, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you. Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, I don't want an answer right now. I just want to state the questions, and then offline you can come back and do that so that we can move forward.
Thank you.
I guess my first question is, why would there be a limit of 25? Could it be less? My second question is, you've got a ratio of 1 to 2 units, so on and so forth. Given the model that you're talking about, and I've actually visited models very similar to that in about 4 foreign countries in Europe, there's flexibility there. The 1 to 2 ratio, I'd like you to come talk to me about that because that can be reduced down. I mean, what it takes, and generally the hamlets we're talking about, at least Swiss, French Alps, things like that, you're not talking more than 10. The other thing, come back, is the covenants, the residential covenant for agricultural operations. And if that covenant is broken, then therefore the county can order the removal of the property. That's the question I have there. And it also pivots into the 85% conservation deal, because if somebody does break this or go out, then what is the recourse here, and what was your intent of recourse? And we can get together after the meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Interesting
proposal.
Next we have Don Schellenberg and Jim Johnson and Don Bischoff. Thank you, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Now, the Oregon Farm Bureau has consistently supported Oregon statewide land use planning program, and that's not to say that it's perfect, but the premise of land use planning is to prevent conflict by separating incompatible uses and to cluster like uses together in order to provide an efficient delivery of services from a stable infrastructure. Oregon's land use planning system does this through a series of goals. Goal 3 was instituted to protect farmland for the purpose of producing agricultural commodities. In the beginning, there were just 7 permitted and conditional non-farm uses allowed in the EFU zones. I mentioned earlier that our planning system was not perfect. Evidence of that is that in the last 25 years, the legislature has allowed an average of 2 non-farm uses to be added to the farm zone every legislative session. So today, there are over 50 listed permitted and conditional uses in the farm zone. One of the major conflicts with non-farm uses is that each one increases the speculative values of farmland, making it increasingly difficult for farmers and ranchers to purchase farmland at prices that can be paid for from the sale of the commodities they produce. A second conflict is the increased traffic generated by non-farm use. As farm size increases, farmers are using larger pieces of equipment and moving them more often from field to field. Increased auto traffic from non-farm uses is a danger to both the producer and the public traveling to and from the non-farm use on a daily basis. A third concern is the accumulative removal of farmland from agriculture production and the injury that that does to the agriculture infrastructure. And in that, I would include water. We have a lot of water-limited areas. Water is a very scarce commodity in a lot of cases. And so other non-farm uses that come out into the farm zone take water that is needed by the agriculture community. It takes a critical mass of land to ensure that the services agriculture needs will remain in place. Fourth, the clientele served by a hospice house facility are the most fragile human beings. The most inappropriate location for such persons would be in the farm zone with adjacent noise at all hours of the day and night by machinery and animals, odor, dust, and the application of pesticides nearby. And while they might establish a hospice house where they think it's a good place to locate and it looks like a serene environment, that could change 2 days later. A large dairy could locate there. Any number of farming agricultural activities could change. So there's no guarantee that it's going to continue to be a nice location. Passage of Senate Bill 508 would allow yet another non-farm use in the farm zone, clogging the roads and providing yet another use competing for limited water supply and a diminishing land base with dollars that are not generated from the production of the soil. Unlike a hospice facility, agriculture is location and soil dependent. Our land use planning system has said EFU zones are where farmland is located. There's no need or reason to site a hospice facility in a farm zone. A hospice facility is not location dependent or soil dependent in order to provide a service. As we learned from the spokesman from the Association of Oregon Counties during other testimony, there are rural industrial zones located all over Oregon where such facilities could be located that would provide a more conducive environment, or even rural residential zones. I mentioned industrial zones. Agriculture is really, it's an industrial zone, but it's an industrial zone that doesn't have walls. And so everything we do is exposed, whereas a rural industrial zone would be a zone where there are industrial activities going on, but they're usually behind walls, and therefore the activities don't impact the surrounding uses. Of course, the most appropriate location is inside any urban growth boundary where sewer, water, medical, and emergency services are readily available. The farm belongs in the farm zone, and that's why it's identified as an exclusive farm use zone. Hospice facilities belong in the urban growth boundary, or for more rural settings, desired or necessary, than perhaps the rural industrial zone or the rural residential zone. So the Oregon Farm Bureau asks you to reject Senate Bill 508. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenberg. I think we'll go to Don Bischoff first. Senator Morissette. I didn't know
that
was for the senator. But
thank you, Chair Smith. My name is Don Bischoff. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Bill Morissette. I'm here in his stead because he's fighting another of his bills through another committee. Senator Morissette is actually a chief co-sponsor of this bill. He just hasn't gotten his name on it yet. This was a gut and stuff of one of Senator George's bills on the Senate side. Senator George agreed to this and, in fact, is supportive of the gut and stuff version of the bill. Senator Morissette believes that the prospect for the hospice house in Lane County is a combination of a unique piece of property and a unique location with a unique set of circumstances, and that's why he has supported this, although he would generally not be a big supporter of carve-outs of EFU land. If the committee has concerns about setting a precedent or of further erosion of genuine forest land elsewhere in the state, the committee, I think, would have the option of placing an amendment in this that would limit it to Lane County, for example, or within a certain distance of an urban growth boundary, and any number of restrictions could be amended in. You do have before you -5 amendments that were requested by the Department of Land Use and Conservation that would place an additional restriction on any hospice house that was located in an exclusive farm use. It's an additional protection against the law being exploited or a loophole being created that allows somebody to come in with a hospice house and then do a land division that could further segment farmland. So I think I'm just here basically to answer any questions you might have about the bill or about how it evolved.
Thank you. Well, we'll go to Jim Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I kind of got caught flat-footed here with the -6 as I was writing an awful lot of notes, and I'll talk about those in a minute, and I've got a lot to say about that. But first, I'd like to focus on the bill at hand without the -- amendments. And a lot was said by Mr. Schellenberg already, so I'll try not to say, pile onto that too much more. But it is another, it would be another non-farm use permitted in an exclusive farm use zone that has over 50 non-farm uses allowed in it already. And Don was correct when he described agriculture as an industrial use. I mean, you've heard this before in relation to a lot of other bills. It's dirty, it's dusty, there's odors, there's use of pesticides, there's a lot of traffic associated with large machinery, and on and on. It would almost seem to me that these two uses are inherently not compatible. And it could not be mitigated through a conditional use process in several cases that is proposed here. You should have it as a handout, a map of the Willamette Valley that shows the location of areas that are zoned within the Willamette Valley other than farm or forest use. And the purpose of that is to show alternatives that could provide rural sites for such facilities without being sited in farm or forest zones. And we would suggest to you that such uses may be better sited in some of these rural residential zones, rural commercial, rural unincorporated communities, or for that matter, some of the small rural urban areas that are also located throughout the Willamette Valley, including the southern Willamette Valley, where compatibility issues are much, much less, and the area has already been planned for non-farm use. I wanted to touch bases real quickly on the residential care facility because that was something that came up in previous testimony. Residential care facilities are allowed in exclusive farm use zones, or for that matter in any zone, as long under the definition of what is a family in terms of 5 unrelated members allowed in a dwelling. And so it's not that residential care facilities are called out as a use permitted in an exclusive farm use zone. They're allowed in a residence as long as it's no more than 5 unrelated members. And if you wanted to get more information on that, I would suggest that you might want to talk to someone at DLCD about that. But I've had a couple of experiences with those in exclusive farm use zones where they've been cited there, and it was under the purview that it was a single-family residence with 5 unrelated members living in that. And that's actually, if I remember right, mandated by federal law that you can't discriminate against those as long as it's 5 or less. So 5 or less unrelated people could also be cited in a residential use as under hospice type of situation, I would believe, under existing law. If you'd like to ask any questions about the hospice thing, I'd stop here now before I switch into the other.
I think we're okay. Just keep going.
Yeah. Okay, I apologize if this is a little bit disconjuncted because I wrote notes down as I was going along and listening to the testimony. I would first again refer you back to that map that I provide you with the non-resource zones in the Willamette Valley. It would seem to me that in response to the comment that was made by the advocates of this, that there are the small towns and communities are withering and dying in the Willamette Valley, that I would submit to you this would be they would be the perfect place to site such a facility, not on land zoned for exclusive farm use, especially the lodging and the restaurant type facilities. A lot of these small communities, even in wine country, Yamhill County, would be excellent locations for these types of things. I submit to you Yamhill, Carlton, Amity, there's even unincorporated communities such as Hopewell, and Rickrell and the like. And for that matter, there's examples of facilities. There's one being proposed within the urban growth boundary right now of Newburgh that would be a lodging facility associated with vineyard operations. So I would submit to you that there are already provisions that would allow for this but not have a large residential footprint on agricultural lands. And again, I'm going to be jumping around here. This issue has been kind of rearing its head off and on during the session, and because of that, I've had some discussions with membership of the Oregon Wine Board. And coincidentally, I had a talk with a member of the board yesterday, and then I received an email again from them today, and they informed me that they voted unanimously to oppose this concept when it was brought forward to them earlier this month. The reason I bring this up is that this has kind of popped out today, and I don't think anybody, for example, from the Oregon Wine Board knew this was on, so they're not here to testify. I'm sure that there were other members of the wine industry that were associated with the proposal that you might have read about in the hills outside of Newburgh that's been to Luba and back that might have something to say about this. And besides the fact that this would take place necessarily in wine country, there are more than just winery operations or grape growing operations in wine country. There are other types of agricultural operations that would have to coexist with this. And so I guess what I'm getting at, there are a lot of compatibility concerns that I would suggest to you that would need to be discussed beyond this. Let me jump around here. Representative McPherson asked about the dwellings, and that was one of the things that jumped out at me also when I quickly looked at this. There's 85% of the land, and the dwellings must be associated with farm use. Well, I would suggest to you that under current law, farm dwellings are permitted. And if a farm and there are provisions that require that it be in conjunction with farm use and that define how that is done. This doesn't do a very detailed job in defining what is farm use and how you would determine whether it was commercial use in conjunction with farm use as currently allowed under state law. If there would be a concern that there needed to be some adjustments to allow for more dwellings on parcels for the like, I would submit to you also that something similar to what Umatilla County recently did, which where they did a rezone recognizing that wine grapes were moving into a different area of the county and changing agricultural pattern, they actually amended their plan to allow a smaller minimum parcel size to recognize that dwellings needed to be sited on smaller parcels associated with vineyards as opposed to wheat operations. That's another option that could be here if residential use is really something that needs to be anticipated here.
That's probably okay for right now.
That's fine, and this isn't very organized and
right.
Such. So
no problem.
I leave it at that in answering questions. We are there's concerns associated with this, and agritourism is not a slam dunk issue in the ag community. For everyone that says they support it, I can show you another farmer that has a problem with it.
Okay. Any questions? Tony Mass. Okay. Thank you all.
Chair Roebling, one
clarification
I forgot to add in response to a question that Representative Clem asked. Under the provisions of the bill, there is an existing property on the land that they plan to use in Eugene, but under the terms of the bill, they could remodel or replace that building so long as it stayed within the 10,000-square-foot limit.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had no one else signed up to talk to this one. We did get some other information, I think everybody got, from DEQ and from the governor's office and others. And DLCD. You should have gotten those letters just recently. So, Representative Fokler.
Just on a related topic, at some point I'd like to get the Department of Agriculture to come back and confirm to be the number of acres in the Willamette Valley in the federal crop reduction program.
Thank you. So that people know, we're going to close our hearing on Senate Bill 508, And as with this other bill, just so people know when we open our next hearing, because these have not been posted to the next week, we have to get permission from the Speaker's office to have a work session or another hearing. And we will also, I will also check with all my committee members to see after the what is there that has a possibility of moving. If there isn't anything, you won't see another hearing. But if there are a group of people who feel strongly and it's a majority, then we'll look at having some work sessions next week on either of these bills. Plus, there's one other that Representative Boquist was having a small group work on. Did you come to something? Do we need to ask for that hearing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've come to a consensus. And just a real quick report, we reviewed the issues revolving around the Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
And come to the conclusion, what we don't know is what we don't know, and therefore have come up with a conceptual idea of between now and the 09 session of how to identify that portion of the trail that still exists that should be preserved in cooperation with the various entities and stakeholders over the next basically 2 years. And so we have an amendment coming forth for that in cooperation with the State Parks Division so that in the next legislative session we'll all know what is still there to preserve, what historical archaeological sites may be there, so that we have more information to deal with in assisting and developing a cooperative effort between landowners, cities, counties, and various entities, and how we might preserve this for the tricentennial.
Okay. Thank you very much.
He's good.
Yes, he is. That was fairly short work and good work. So right now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 572A, and we have a lot of people to talk and not a lot of time. As you know, we have about 45 minutes, but we'll try to get as many as we people, so if you can keep your testimony down so we can get a feel of this whole thing, it would be helpful. With that, we'll have a short description of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 572A would prohibit the hunting of an exotic mammal or game mammal held or obtained by a person. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. And Senator Deckert is here.
You haven't said, like, good afternoon.
I just was looking down, and I'm going to sit up and say, good afternoon. It's great to have you here. Thank you for coming and visiting our committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. This is my first time, I think, before certainly your committee in the House, whatever great name you have for this.
Natural Resources.
This Natural Resources Committee. Mr. Chair, you have a lot of folks to testify, so I will be very brief. We have been at this for many, many years, passed bills on this. ODF&W Commission has unanimously, in my understanding, in 1999, passed a commission rule to really go after something I think we could all agree upon is not the type of activity that we want to sanction in our state, and that is fencing in and shooting animals that are fenced in small enclosures, and oftentimes exotic animals. It is just not Oregon at its best. It is not the values that we hold as a state. And so we have been, under your guidance, Mr. Chair, working with a lot of the stakeholders, ODF&W, the Department of Agriculture, many groups that are particularly interested in this, and hopefully you'll hear some very good testimony, short, brief testimony, I'll say, to the folks behind me, that we've reached that point of, if not consensus, near consensus in terms of how you really go at these type of operations that I have yet to hear, at least in my tenure here, folks really defend, and hopefully you'll hear from some hunting groups that this actually is a black mark on all the good hunting and sportsmanship that goes on in this state, and something that now for the final time we can put an end to in the state of Oregon, and ensure that any facility that is thinking about locating here or ones, that this is not something that we approve of in this state. And thank you for your assistance in moving this bill along, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this esteemed witness? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate you having me here. Let's just get on the list. So next we'll have Kelly Peterson. Is it Beverly Paul? And Sandra Farnsworth. Oh, okay, you have one other person. So then we'll just go back to Beverly. If you want to come on up.
Am I on that line also, sir?
Ted Paul. Yeah, but we've only got room for those two plus one right now. So if you want to wait and
seat right here.
Okay.
It's getting too many names on the same line. I just have to double the number of people around. That's right.
You want me to go first?
No, I'll go first. No.
I'll go first.
Kelly, you can go first.
Okay. Sorry.
Thanks.
Chair Romland and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm here on behalf of the Humane Society of the United States. I'm the Oregon Program Director. And I'm also accompanied by John Laverne, who's our legal counsel. And we're here today representing our 130,000 members and constituents here in Oregon. Although when I started, this is an issue I became aware about just from a TV program back in 1997. I was simply a constituent and not even really aware that obviously this occurred, Cantons, and also how to do anything about it. I had never even testified before the legislature, nor was I aware of what, you know, ODFNW, what their agency had the capability of doing. But I will say, after nearly a two-year review, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission unanimously adopted an administrative rule back in April of 1999, similar to the language before you, which attempted to ban canned hunts of exotic and game mammals. And I don't think Senator Deckard went into this, so I don't want to repeat myself, but canned hunting operations or game ranches are really private trophy hunting facilities that offer their customers an opportunity to kill exotic or game mammals that are trapped within fenced enclosures with no chance to escape and shot at close range. The commission back in 1999 approved the regulation really after discussions with hunting representatives, private citizens, Oregon State Police, and after listening to over 8 hours of testimony from private citizens, and there were three different commission meetings, which I think one took place in Pendleton. The overall of the testimony was in support of it, except for obviously the one person who did operate at that time a facility, along with, I think, the Ted Nugent Hunting Club and Safari Club. They testified in opposition. Still, the commission reviewed thoroughly the information before them. They weighed all the options, and they came to the unanimous decision to ban canned hunts with no exceptions for even specific operators. Editorial boards and outdoor writers even weighed in on the issues, and I've included some of that in your materials. So it's 2007, and because of ongoing legal wranglings and some of the exceptions in the existing regulation, Oregon really doesn't have any practical canned hunt law at all. And Senate Bill 572, the A. Engrossed Amendment, seeks to clarify that. And I won't go into necessarily the Oregon Supreme Court case that kind of prompted some of this, but there were 51 violations against one of the operators that we know is public and has a facility like this. They were thrown out, this past November, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld ODFNW's authority to regulate captive non-indigenous deer only. And so, therefore, you know, the one facility that we know of is still in operation. It's operating business as usual. We'll say that there could be others in Oregon, but that's something we don't yet know about. But some of the animals that are sold in these facilities include Corsican sheep for about $600, Russian boar for $700, ibex for $1,500, and the Hawaiian black sheep for about $800. So 572A would really outlaw canned hunting of all game and exotic mammals, giving the commission's original regulation the full force of the law, with no exceptions based on definition with respect to if it's classified as a domestic animal. You know, it just doesn't really make sense to protect certain exotic trophy mammals and not others because of the loophole within the canned hunt law. And these animals behind the fences are large-scale trophy animals with big price tags, and they're commonly found on canned hunt operations all around the country. And in your attachments, you can actually see the copy of the administrative rule that was passed in 1999, and you can compare it to the original, the language before you today. We did work with ODFNW and Legislative Council to make sure that was reflected in the bill and that it was consistent with other wildlife statutes and definitions. And as Senator Deckard mentioned, we are having ongoing discussions with the Oregon Department of Agriculture to make sure any of their concerns are addressed in the bill.
I want to also just mention briefly that the damage statute, the ORS 498.012, does provide authority for a person to take wildlife that's damaging any property, and that provision overrides everything else in the game code, so including this bill. So the authority to trap or take nuisance animals like nutria already exists, and that would, you know, exist even after the bill passed. And nothing in the law would prohibit the legal taking of wildlife for hunting or trapping, and this bill certainly would not supersede any existing wildlife laws. So I don't know how much. I do want to address one other point, and that's really the aspect of the size of an enclosure, and that has been some of the discussion. And, you know, can hunt ranches take place with animals that are raised in captivity? They are, you know, semi-tame animals that have lost much of their fear of humans. Their survival skills when hunted are minimal. They have really nowhere to go. The size of the enclosure is really irrelevant because the animals are just unable to change their behavior. When you're hunting animals in the wild, wild animals, they have, when they hear gunshots, they do have, you know, they do change their behavior. And these animals, they have nowhere to go but within the fenced-in enclosure. And, you know, game ranches and hunting preserves employ guides that are paid to know where their whereabouts are, where their hideouts are, where they feed, where they drink. And these animals just are not able to escape from the gunshots, and which is really the core of fair chase hunting. And so, you know, these animals are really sitting ducks, whether they're in a 2,000-acre or whether they're in a 5-acre or 50-acre enclosure. These hunts are virtually guaranteed. They're not free-roaming wild animals. When the regulation was approved back in 1999, there were only 12 states that had partial or full bans on canned hunts. Today, there's 20. And really, Oregon still does not have anything on the books. And that is substantive, that is clear and concise, and there's, right now, there's certain animals that are just in legal limbo because of some of the definitions. And this is an issue that should have been addressed back in 1999, and so I'm really grateful to those co-sponsors who introduced the bill. It's something that does mean a lot to Oregonians, and I just urge your support. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing further to add unless there's questions.
Okay.
Yeah, unless there are some questions on legal.
Okay. Do you want to ask questions or we'll just go? Okay. Next.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As a matter of introduction, my name is Beverly Ann Paul, and I am the president of Beautiful America Publishing Company. You more than likely have one of our books or calendars in your home right now. My home is in South Salem. I will not bore you with my version of the pros and cons of the bill at hand, as I know you are all very familiar with the facts. My approach to this bill is from a little different point of view. Great men over the ages have seen and recognized the need for kindness and fair, and I emphasize the word fair treatment of animals. A few among them are Abraham Lincoln, Albert Schweitzer, who said, "Anyone who has accustomed himself to regard the life of any living creature as worthless is in danger of arriving also at the idea of worthless human lives." Chief Seattle and Mahatma Gandhi, who said, and I quote, "The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated." No one is asking that hunting be abated, but I am sure that Chief Seattle, who certainly believed in hunting, would turn over in his grave if he knew of a canned hunt. When our National Congress is taking giant steps to protect animals every single week, it only makes sense that Oregon should follow suit. Last week was a landmark week in the recognition for the fair treatment of animals when President Bush signed into law a bill relating to the protection of animals. And the Philadelphia Zoo, the oldest zoo in the country, released all of their animals to a sanctuary, and not one where they can be enclosed and killed for a trophy. Numerous other states have already put laws on the books completely banning canned hunts, including, would you believe, Montana? Oregon cannot afford to fall so drastically behind in our thinking and action on this matter. I will close with a quote from Tony La Russa, the manager of the 2006 World Series champions, the St. Louis Cardinals. The work always begins as it did on that ball field in 1990, with the special moment when an animal and a person connect and respond to the needs of each other. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? None? Well, would you like to come up now, Mr. Paul?
Sure.
I'll let you do yours before I have my next group come up.
Way to go, Kit. Hey, she's good, isn't she?
She is.
Tough act to follow, that lady. My name is Ted Paul, for the record. Beverly is my wife, and in case you didn't catch the connection on that last thing about the St. Louis Cardinals, raise your hand. Because it was when a little cat strolled out onto the ball field and began to be chased by all of the attendants to the roar of the Roman crowd who said, down with the cat. And the man that went out there and took the cat was Tony La Russa. And it's his cat to this day. I make that clarification only because there's a lot of people who watch ball games and don't care much about the cats. Let me tell you why I am here, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here because I'm an ex-hunter. I was born and raised in a suburb outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and my father, a wonderful man, took me under his arm and he said, Ted, I want to teach you how to hunt. So I was taught the correct way. I learned about weapons, and I respected them. I learned about the game we were going to hunt, pheasant and rabbit mostly in Ohio. I was taught that we respect them. We don't shoot hens, we shoot the cockbird. My dad just took me by the hand and led me out into the snow-covered fields at Thanksgiving time and said, you also respect the land. You don't just turn around and unload your shotgun at a stop sign someplace, as we see so often. He taught me the correct way to hunt. And shortly after that, being a hunter, I changed. We're all allowed that. I no longer cared to take a life, even if it was a pheasant or a rabbit. And I told my dad, I said, Dad, I just don't care to hunt anymore. He looked at me and he says, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. He says, at least now you know, if you do, the correct way to do it. And he said to me, he says, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to quit hunting, both my dad and myself. And the next day he came home with a skeet trap. And we took our shotguns and we went out there and really honed our skills. And that was the last time either of us handled a weapon until we went into the service. And I went in with great skills. And folks, I just have to tell you, this state of Oregon has many, many tremendous, wonderful hunters. I would say the percentage of people trained like myself is up in the upper 90s. Respectable people who go out and know how to hunt and respect the laws and respect the property and respect the animals they're hunting. But then we have a small few who unfortunately are being labeled hunters when in actuality murderers would be closer to it, who go out to a canned area containing exotic animals that have been raised from little baby animals domestically to where they recognize man as their best friend. He's the one that feeds me. I have no problem with this man. And yet, oh, suddenly they're in this little fenced-in area, and up comes another man carrying a rifle. And he kneels at the edge of the pen, hardly farther than you and I, and he takes that unsuspecting animal's life in a canned hunt. Why? Well, get a trophy. And in case you're wondering about it, I have some of the advertisements from Clover Creek Ranch, the one in question, and it starts out with their 2006 pricing. And it mentions $2,000 for a Akudad. Corsican sheep, $750. And they go on and they guarantee you're going to get your trophy. Why? Because they're right there in that pen. And why is it a trophy? Because at that range, my friends, you just aim at the heart. You don't put it in the forehead. You're not destroying a pest or a beast or something that's running wild. You're taking the life of a domestic animal. And I can't see where we can call them hunters. I have a few chosen names of my own, if you'd like to hear them later. Thank you so much. I trust we can get this bill passed, finally.
Thank you.
Any questions, gentlemen?
I think we're okay.
Thank you, sir.
So I think what I'd like to do, since we have kind of a mix of people who are for and against, is kind of go back and forth, because I think that's the fair way. So, but right now what I will do is bring out a couple people who have kind of listed as neutral, and they're just people who are here from our agencies. So Roy Elliker and Bill Cook. And Katie and Lauren, do you want to both come on up too? We can kind of figure out a way to get you all there. So we've got agriculture and Fish and Wildlife.
I didn't know Roy was neutral on anything.
Well, he didn't check it. They didn't check.
Katie's not. So
okay.
Three, four, pull that last one. I can't answer the question. This is Jim Dill or Hatchet.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name, for the record, Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my left, Mr. Bill Cook, Department of Justice and Council on Wildlife Affairs. Katie introduced herself here, and Lauren, when we get Department of Agriculture. I have some prepared testimony, but I know time is brief. I just want to make a couple points. Following some of Kelly's testimony, there was a bill introduced in the 69th session regarding canned hunts. At that point, the bill did not go forward, but a number of legislators asked the commission to look into the practice and perhaps prepare regulations regarding it. The commission did that with an extensive public process over a number of meetings, public hearings, extensive testimony, both sides, and did come up with a rule that's attached as your attachment one, which has been in effect since 1999. Except, however, now that there has been a recent Oregon Supreme Court case which modified the definition of wild birds and wild mammals, and which does have a substantial effect on this current rule. So as we speak here today, the Commission's rules as regarding mallet mammals and canned hunts are invalid until we figure out how to deal with this new interpretation that the Supreme Court has directed us to look into. In the meantime, however, regarding the bill, two things for us. First of all, it elevates the regulations from being regulations to statutory, as you know. And second of all, it would extend the canned hunting ban in terms of species to mammals, which at the time were exempted by the Commission in its rule in 1999. And I can get into that in some more detail, but it has to do somewhat. I think I have members for our Division 56 rules where the Commission specifically designated what mammals or wildlife, what mammals are domestic or otherwise exempt. And so the rule the Commission promulgated in 99 is based on these species-specific lists of mammals. So, and I think that the I think, Chair Roblin, we had actually discussed this list in quite detail in another bill in front of this committee, so I didn't think the need to kind of go into it here. But that ends my comments. Mr. Cook's here to answer any questions on the legal side.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Katie Koba, Director, Department of Agriculture. We have gotten engaged in discussions around this bill because of the challenge of writing a statute broad enough to get at the issue of a canned hunt, and given existing legal language, the unintended consequences of pulling in standard agricultural practices under that statutory prohibition. So we have been working with all of the parties to try to figure out a way to clarify an exemption in the bill that would take out standard practices that you would see on an agricultural operation dealing with animals and not have those be subjected to the canned hunt prohibitions. The amendments are being drafted, but in essence, what this would do would allow, let's say, a livestock producer who raises cattle and will perhaps once a year go out and take one of his own animals for personal consumption. It would allow him to do that. It would allow producers who have a downed animal that need to take that animal for humane reasons or safety reasons would allow them to do that. It would also allow the folks that we contract with to do predatory control work to allow that to continue. So we believe, based on the conversations that we've had, that we've got some amendments that are being drafted that can allow agriculture to continue to operate and not get caught up in the definitions that would need to be included in the statute. One of the challenges that we have is virtually all livestock in the state is not native, so it gets caught up in this notion of what's exotic, including Holsteins and Anguses and goats and sheep and those kinds of things.
Okay. Some questions? I have one. I guess I'll give this to Roy. If we had the same definition that we had before in wildlife, and so we had all the rules in place that we currently have with regard to wildlife and agricultural and so on, and this bill went into effect, would it stop the one canned hunt area we have right now from doing what they're doing, in your opinion? I mean, could they continue to take other animals that are on that list? I mean,
Chair Rowland, if I'm tracking your question correctly, am I to assume that the bill would be enacted as drafted now that broadly says we're talking about mammals and not necessarily limited to wildlife?
I would say it would be more, a little more limited, because I've got to make sure that I get my agricultural people out of it.
Right. My understanding of what's on the brochure from Clover Creek Ranch is that there are a few species that are clearly wildlife as we are accustomed to thinking about it. The rest fall into the category of domestic wildlife and a number of hybrids. So it depends how the definition came out. If it's as broad as now in the statute in the bill, I think it would pick up just about everything on the list.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, perhaps I can clarify as well. Again, Katie Koba, Department of Agriculture. Where we ended up in our most recent discussions was not trying to define the species, but rather focusing on the method of take. And so the amendments that you're coming to you discussed slaughter, because in essence in the agricultural world that's what we consider when we take an animal, slaughter, and trying to differentiate that from hunt. So we're using a person, a custom slaughter facility or a mobile slaughter facility, taking an animal in an accepted slaughtering method, which we have defined statutes for, that would be allowed. So we're getting away from trying to do this species by species and differentiating hunt from the slaughter.
My concern then would be if they asked people to come out and have a controlled slaughter, would they be able to do the same things they're doing?
Yeah. Chair Roland, members of the committee. The commission was the one that first came up with the idea of slaughter as a way of setting aside legitimate agricultural operations. Our view of the term was slaughtering is when you take an animal for meat, fur, leather production.
Okay.
You do get into a fact issue, but I think you run into that almost any mechanism you use. But our view was that with that kind of substance, to the exception, it would put cantons on one side and legitimate farming and ranching on the other.
Okay. Representative Klein.
Yeah, I think I want to try and get that same question. I mean, this isn't a hypothetical. This is a real person who came to my house to ask me about this. This is like a five-acre property outside of Salem, somewhere out south, and a gentleman lives there and has some sheep and then puts in the Capital Press, I'll sell you one of my sheep, you know, to kill and eat. And the average person will come out and say, great. And currently either he goes out and shoots it or he says, go ahead and go shoot it and, you know, give me my money. And it, would that be considered a canned hunt when he considers himself basically a sheep farmer? And is it who does it that's the issue, or is that a canned hunt? And he said there's a lot of people who do it in the Capital Press.
Sorry,
apparently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, not being an attorney, first of all, my guess is that even if this bill is passed, there will probably more than likely be a court case that tries to further clarify this. What we are trying to get at under slaughter is, in the instance that you described, I would assume that would be acceptable, regardless if the owner of the animal killed it or the person who came out and purchased it. What we were trying to get at in our discussions is a canned hunt tends to be more of a sporting or an entertainment kind of an activity versus a slaughter of a sheep for meat as you walk out, you humanely kill the animal, and then you take it and you process it and you use it for personal meat consumption. But my guess is that someone will challenge that and it will ultimately be decided in court.
Just a follow-up. So in this proposed amendment that's not yet ready but might look something like what we got from Senator Deckard, it uses the term custom slaughter establishment. So a person...
Comma,
custom processing. Oh, so that would, in his case, it would be a person. You don't have to be a person on a custom slaughter establishment, because then he'd probably call his house a
that's
custom
correct.
Slaughter establishment. Huh.
No, you can be a person.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
A lot of questions. Mr. Chair, how does this dovetail with that other bill that we were working already about restoring to the commission their rules?
804, right?
804.
Yeah.
804. I would say they're interconnected only because there is no definition right now, and so other animals can come in and we don't have any control over them. From my personal belief, that one's totally different. It has nothing to do with it. It has to do with reestablishing the ability for our people to control invasive, I wouldn't call them invasive species, I call them, you know, other animals that shouldn't be here, and getting that right back to them. That's a different issue than this bill is.
However, Mr. Chair, they're connected to the exact same legal case.
That's true. Mm-hmm. They are connected to the same legal case. So we've heard pro, con, neutral, and now we'll go with a few con, and we've got a little while. So three people. Molly Schaefer. Larry Harvey. And Jim Welch. Yeah, they're never very easy. And then we should have one more panel after this, and that will be everybody. So that's good.
Am I going first?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Molly Schaefer. I run a USDA licensed facility outside Salem. For the record, I'm not a hunter, although I'm not against hunting. I'm one of the people that will get caught up in the crossfire and the language of this bill. I don't believe the bill is written very well. There's several things that bother me. The fact that it falls under ORS 498, which is again, wildlife is a property of the state. No person shall purchase, sell, or exchange, or offer to purchase, sell, or exchange any wildlife or any part thereof. The other thing with this bill, it's being presented as a canned hunt bill, but I've looked at it repeatedly, and I don't see the words canned hunt anywhere in that bill, which concerns me for other reasons. And I know you just talked to Katie Cope a little bit, but the other thing it doesn't address is mobile slaughtering businesses, which most of the farmers in my area, that's what they use is mobile slaughtering. And also with the inherently dangerous meat animals, such as buffalo, water buffalo, that really is the only option to safely kill those animals. They cannot be loaded and trailered and taken to a normal slaughterhouse. They just don't have handling facilities for those type of animals. Again, as an 804, the most objectionable part of this bill to me is lines 3 and 4. Lines 3 stating, State Fish and Wildlife Director may authorize a person to kill a mammal described in this section if the director determines that allowing a person to kill a mammal is in the best interest of sound management of wildlife. The word wildlife in there, I got big issues with. And then line 4 describing an exotic mammal is any mammal not native to Oregon, whether that mammal is foreign or introduced. That can be your dog and cat. It's not referring to animals that are hunted, specifically hunted. That's any animal that's non-indigenous to the state, which is most animals that exist today. It's my opinion that Senate Bill 572, as it's written, is not a canned hunt bill. It directly interferes with Oregon agriculture, the Oregon meat industry, and personal property rights of average citizens. This bill could criminalize many traditional farm and ranch practices in the state, and upholding this law could cause undue suffering to many animals, and I oppose the bill. Thank you
very much.
Chair Roblin, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen Association. And as the bill is written, we would oppose. But as you have heard from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, we've been working with them on trying to come up, first understanding what the bill is trying to do and making sense of this and then trying to apply some things that would protect the livestock industry. We don't want unintended consequences, and I think they've gotten really close with their amendments, and that's what concerns us. So if we can go forward with whatever dash those are and we get those resolved,
okay,
we'll be all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. Thanks, members of the committee, for just a few comments. You have in front of you actually a letter from the... Did I turn that off? No. You have in front of you a letter from the party actually involved here in the litigation that's been discussed for years, and I can assure you it has been years. The Clarks are out of town at the wedding of their daughter today, so they could not be here, and I'm sure we all wish them well, regardless of how we might feel about their business. Nevertheless, this bill is inherently flawed, and I think we would do well to back up a little bit and try to take a look at exactly what it is that the proponents want to do versus the reality of what goes on in Oregon. Okay, the fact of the matter is that we are talking about hunting. I'm not sure there's a legal, and perhaps Representative McPherson could help us here, but I'm not sure there's a legal definition in statute that says what a canned hunt is. So I don't know what a canned hunt is, personally. I know what's been portrayed here as a canned hunt, shooting an animal that's caged at close range. If you want to talk about the Clover Creek Ranch specifically, 2,500 acres doesn't seem like close range to me. So then we have to start working on other definitions as to exactly what it is that we're getting at. If we want to talk about slaughter, and the fact of the matter is that all of the meat from animals that are taken at Clover Creek Ranch is not only used on the market, but in fact over 3,000 pounds are donated to feed homeless people, to feed indigent families, and to feed other folks who otherwise may not have a meal that night or for many nights after that. So I'm not quite sure that changing the definition for slaughter will help as well. My cousin is a cattle rancher and deals with over 30,000 head of cattle every year. I mean, from my personal opinion, the way cattle are slaughtered is not what I exactly call humane in the way that we're discussing it today. So my suggestion is that we kind of try to divorce that of the emotionalism of what we're trying to deal with, because I love animals as much as anyone else here. I have a 9-year-old beagle that sleeps on my bed every night, and I would not want anything to happen to him. Now, from a legal standpoint of what we want to do, if there's something specific that we need to do, and I'm assuming that there is, we even know that our agencies have some conflict here. And I think that both Director Koba as well as Deputy Director Elliger have very well articulated what those are, and I'm not sure that making a decision today or even next Wednesday will resolve those differences per se. What I do know is that this committee has already sent out to the floor Senate Bill 804 with some very specific directions and a commitment from Deputy Director Elliger that we would go back to redefining what's the different categories are under the following the Supreme Court decision that evidently threw all of this into great turmoil. I think that that's appropriate. I think that that's appropriate because Director Elliger also committed to having public input. And I think that citizens like Molly Schaefer here, whose livelihoods are at stake, have a right to participate in that. So within that context, it seems like we're rushing here to get ahead of ourselves without having even taken a look at what it is that we want to do with 804. I have a tremendous amount of confidence in both of the agencies. They don't always agree, but that's why we have checks and balances in the system, just like the House and the Senate don't always agree. But that's why we have a process. It's interesting, and I will close with this. I had the privilege, I guess, of getting a briefing today on a recent Supreme Court decision with regard to waste and who gets to manage flow. Justice Roberts wrote that within the context of the balance between public and private sector, the only time the government should have a right to step in and regulate is if, in fact, under the Commerce Clause, there is a lack of balance between the burden versus the responsibility of the government to regulate. I don't know how far that could be stretched. I found it a very interesting opinion, particularly as it applies to business across the board throughout our nation. So I would submit that since that can't be determined in 572, that we're a little bit ahead of ourselves, and we ought to let the agencies involved run their course and write the rules for 804 so that they can then come back and tell us.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. And our last panel. Now, Sandra, thank you for being so patient. And Andrew Moore and Laura, is it Ireland? Moore? And then there's one other person, Jennifer, is it Chang?
Chang.
So I think that's four people, but if we can get as many as we can up here, that'd be great.
Oh, go ahead. Laura will not be testifying.
Oh, okay. Okay, that'd be great. So we can start out with Sandra.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and committee members. My name is Sandra Farnsworth, and I'm with the Oregon Humane Society. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today in support of Senate Bill 572. This is not the first time that the Oregon Humane Society has testified against unfair hunting in our state. There is little about this bill in respects to can hunts that you haven't already heard today. When this hunting was banned by ODFW in 1999, we thought that we were done with this type of activity in Oregon. Today, ibex deer have protections, but any other exotic wildlife on Eastern Oregon's Clover Creek Ranch is waiting right this minute to be someone's trophy catch. The Oregon Supreme Court has already ruled that the ibex deer has protection under the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Oregon Humane Society urges the House of Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee to consider the same protection to other exotic wildlife in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Moore. I currently reside in Portland, Oregon, and my comments are brief. I grew up hunting and fishing, and perhaps I was sheltered, but I had never heard of canned hunts. I had never heard of hunting animals within a fenced enclosure. I'd never heard of having food set out to know where the animal is going to be so you can kill it. And to me, that struck me as fundamentally wrong. You know, there was no sense of fair play in that. To me, it's like a boxing match against an opponent who has his hands tied. And to me, I urge you to pass the bill out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Shang, constituent. Thank you for your time today. At the risk of repeating some of our other people today, I have to agree that enclosing animals and offering them up to hunters is unfair, it's unethical, and it's wrong. I urge you to support this bill and pass it.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
That is all of the people who signed up to testify today. What I told the group, I think most people were here, because this was not posted to the next week, we have to get permission from the speaker's office before we can do that. I will take the temperature of all the board members, and if, in fact, there is a way that this bill can move forward with enough votes to pass, we'll be considering it next week if given permission. Otherwise, it won't be posted because we aren't going to get the permission. So that's kind of where it's at right now, and I'll keep people informed as we go along. And we will be trying to get the Oregon Trail Bill amendments ready to go. With that, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 572A. And I thank all of you for being here. Any other things? I would tell you that we are having a meeting next week. What day did we schedule?
Tuesday.
On Tuesday, there is a Hinkle Creek study that they've been doing for forestry, where they've taken a stream at Hinkle Creek and they put different things in it, structures, and they have been watching the fish for the last couple of years. They have another creek in the Trask that doesn't have those amenities, and so they're doing a double-blind study to see if, in fact, these things are working, and they have some information about that. We will be inviting the other energy and
environment
to come here as well and hear that same presentation. So just want to let that know. And with that, we will close our hearing on ag natural resources. Pardon?